Well, thank you, David. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. I'd like to say I'm perfectly coordinated with yesterday's first speaker about the challenges going forward, but I'm really not talking about global one world issues or, I hope, insightfulness, possibly resilience. So I'd like to start with this wonderful title, which was given to me, and it sounds the longest thing in the world, but I am going to concentrate more on the simple matters of declining fertility, problems with transition cows, and possibly milk production as well. But first, let me have my get out of jail card. My career has been for about 40 years on trying to diagnose and prevent preterm labor, so these are the critters that I have worked with most. From this, you'll understand that the science I'm going to present to you is really about something related to yesterday, which was the Vice Chancellor's speech. It's all about partnerships. And in case I run out of time, I'm going to start by my acknowledgements. And this partnership, as you can see up top, these are my staff and students, all good Australian-born Sri Lankans, Indonesians, Singaporeans, and a Saudi Arabian. But down here, it's a partnership that I've had for over 15 years. All the hard yards are done by the people off the end there, working on the farm, whose names always get left off the acknowledgements, and I'll apologize to them, but they're the ones who've made the work go. And the people who set up the animal models and get the sampling are down here, plus Claire Finn at the end and some others. Mallory, who's now a doctor, but was a master's student with me many, many years ago. John, who had sent his regards and couldn't make it. He said he's busy with meetings. Those of us who know him, of course, will know he's still celebrating last Saturday's event. My grandfather's from Dundalk, Ireland, so I can mention the event, but having been upstairs at the museum last year, I'll refrain from further comment about the second best team in the world. So these are the players. And so if you have hard questions, I'm going to put out details of the experimental plans. But Chris is in the audience right there. And Suzanne has done huge amounts in getting them all organized. So they'll be the people to tell you the nuts and bolts. But I have presented them, but I wouldn't claim that I understand it all. Now I'm going to talk to you about medical, biomedical advances, and how they can be used in the challenges facing Australasian dairy farming. I think I should start off, though, by saying how the reverses work. We all know animal models lead to great advances in human condition and such, but very few use large animals. It's really hard. And so the people who've used dairy cows, say, are few and far between. But the greatest example comes from New Zealand. I hope those of you out there, if there's anyone who doesn't recognize Mont Liggins, go smack yourself, really. So this is Mont Liggins at Ag Research. Mont's an obstetrician, was an obstetrician. He went out to Ag Research twice a week from Auckland, worked with the sheep, got them pregnant, not personally, would take them back to Auckland, chronically catheterized fetuses, externalize and put the catheters in baggies, run them out on One Tree Hill. Cheap, saving money, efficient. That was when there was a tree on One Tree Hill, that far back. And in his research, he was looking at mechanisms of parturition, and he found one compound, a glucocorticoid, would induce labor. And he published that, and we all said, that's fantastic. But smart guy, he said, damn, these fetuses shouldn't be breathing. They're breathing after I've delivered them, way premature. You know, I might try a clinical trial on that. And he and Ross Howie did that, published it in 72. In 1991, 20 years later, NIH had a consensus conference. And they said, my God, that's great. It's true. The sheep farmer from out in Auckland, somewhere down there on the map, has it right. And so every year, 1 million babies are saved. How's that? That's New Zealand. That was Mont. And his son, who was my dentist, told me, you know, never commercialized it, never made one red cent. So all of you with commercial and IP things, probably the greatest breakthrough in 100 years in our field, nothing. So I'm going to do the reverse, but I really would like to make some dollars if I ever could. So I am only going to talk to you about one real topic, but in terms of frontiers, if you take out imaging, which is spectacular, I'll briefly mention the microbiome because this is spectacular and there are plenty of other experts around. The CRISPR, Cas9, used for gene editing, spectacular. It's a game changer worldwide in gene editing. It's just incredible. Most days I'd like to try and remember what it stands for, but I think it's clustered, reliably interspersed, regularly interspersed, small repeats. Okay, so microbiome, you heard a bit about it yesterday. So microbiomes, there's oral, vaginal, cervical, and obviously here the gut. They do wonders. You wonder what happens when you give antibiotics, but it is a huge, huge business. Altering the microbiome, all those bugs, as you know, in us humans, it's thought there's maybe 10 of these microbial cells to every human cell. So we're all really microbes of one sort or another. Although recent data might suggest it's near a 1-to-1. Still, you'll hear more about that from people far more expert than me. But I would guess that's going to become a huge, huge issue in the dairy industry. CRISPR, when you tease away all the basic science and the fact that it's from a prokaryotic adaptive immune response, basically it's a way you can get in, target DNA, clip it precisely and accurately in ways we've never been able to do, and then with some guiding in the Cas9 proteins, you can actually, in the old days of a few years ago, you could block genes, but now you can insert genes reliably. And so I think those of you interested in IVF and embryo transfers and that, here's a way to insert some kind of genetic markers and traits that you might want. And so that will probably revolutionize how these things are done. And we certainly are working with the beef industry in doing that in Duinbar. So the third one is exosomes, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, because I've worked on that a few years. Exosomes, as you can see here, are small, 30 to 100 nanometers. I'll show you a little thing about them, but they are secreted from inside the cell and carry both markers of the cell and information about the metabolic state of the cell. You can measure them in a variety of ways, and we've said about them. And they come here, as you see, multivesicular bodies, here and extruded. But here is where they're picking up all kinds of compounds. So I have a little video, and this one's a 30-second video, so don't worry. So the cells extrude lots of extracellular vesicles of different sizes, but the small ones are ones that just come from inside. Because they're membrane bound, it's fantastic. They can take intracellular mediators that can go around the body, messenger RNA, microRNAs. They can take them around without being degraded. Then by targeting mechanisms we don't understand, they can actually find another cell, get taken up, and they go in and they intercalate into the genetic machinery. All the biological processes are there, including trophoblast-endometrium interactions. So one of the earliest studies, which I like to quote, is here where they take exosomes from a mouse that's containing all these intracellular mediators. They stick them into human cells, and guess what? Mouse proteins come out of the human cells. So that's what I mean. You can take exosomes with all this equivalent, forget about all the retroviral ways to do gene therapy, an exosome will do it for you. And by the way, the first ever gene therapy, which was done by Matt Turing, in New Zealand many years ago, was in the brain, and exosomes will cross the brain. You can shoot them into the tail vein of a mouse and then find it in specific areas of the brain having specific actions. I'm not sure that that's helpful in dairy cows, but it is spectacular. So I'm just going to talk to you. Oh, a little thing stopped. Simply diagnostic, prognostic, and a little bit of therapeutics. That's what we're going to look at. That's what we were working with Dairy NZ on, trying to find a way to assess and get markers, or what I call signatures, of higher or lower fertility or of vulnerability to disease in transition cows, and eventually in terms of milk production. So we've published two sets of papers on this. One early on, where we looked at higher and lower fertility amongst two groups of cows with New Zealand versus North American genetics, and one where we are looking at similar background, but it is a BV-related system. So the fertile, and I apologize, I've been whacked around the head about what's high and low fertility and what words to use, but basically, as you can imagine, the North American genetics were a problem, and the New Zealand genetics, not a problem, but then again, milk production would be the reverse. The high and low fertility, this is the last data I had from Suzanne, but I know they're getting better and better. So you've got extremes in breeding value, and so other factors such as genetics were held constant, which I suspect is a much better model. So what we did is we took the exosomes from the high and low, cleaned and isolated and purified them, and there are no agreed methods to do that. We have published good methods on it, I believe. Looked at the fertile and subfertile in both groups. Looked in the exosomes, and at the moment we've just done the proteomic analysis. We are going up to get the microRNA, which can be quite spectacular. So here we are. There are more exosomes in number in the high fertility. And again, we're talking about 10 to the 10th of these little vesicles than in low fertility. But their size, the diameter, is pretty well the same. If we just look at the latest model, we can see this, but look, potentially, these are the markers we need to investigate to find out, are they actually unique or close to unique? And even with that, are they at all useful? Because developing assays will take some time. Clearly, sensitivity of the assays running through a mass spec, we can do a lot better when we develop our own methods. So you can see here, protein profiles different. Glycodelin was quite different between the two. Oh, hi, Mallory, you are here. I'm glad to see it. So glycodelin's quite an interesting one. It's a decidual marker, I thought. But anyway, it is associated with cellular metabolic processes. Comes from the endometrium and ovary, and it's timely expression. This is what makes it unique. Timely expression is critical. Comes out at the wrong time, it's a problem. Comes out at the right time, it's necessary. And so, and at the bottom, just to show you, these are the exosomal markers of the membrane, which is how we pull these exosomes out. I have to say, these can be improved on. At the moment, we just take all the exosomes. There are ways, if we can find unique markers of a tissue of origin, that we can pull them out. It's called a Q-dot, and imagine the improvement in sensitivity. It'd probably be two orders of magnitude. And say, and I'll show it later, if you wanted placental ones, there's things called PLAP and such. And then you can actually pull with an antibody out, and then you've got rid of 95% maybe of all the other exosomes. And so these measurements all improve radically. So being an old-time physiologist, reproductive biologist, I thought, well, just measuring them, what does that tell me? Not much. It tells me something. It's good. So we thought, well, let's put them on the cells and look at the pathways that they activate or don't activate and see if that tells us a bit more about why the high and the low fertility are such. So we, and this would be Mallory, I think, in one of the studies, took the exosome, took 10 to the 8th, express them, put them into epithelial and stromal cells, which were gifts from Canada, from Montreal. And then we had sonicated ones, and I won't show you, the controls all work beautifully. Well, the other findings, you say, but this was fascinating. This is fascinating. In the endometrial stromal cells, we found that these CXCL9 and 10, which are critical factors for trophoblast endometrium adherence and coming together, hugely reduced. And I put this into percentage, and I have to take the variation out. It's about 10%, the standard deviations, if you like to know. But it made it clear that these interactions are reduced when there are exosomes from low fertility dairy cows. And here also, an anti-inflammatory like IL-4 is suppressed in the lower fertility group. Well, that seemed pretty good. And then we got around to looking at the pro-inflammatory factors. And sure enough, the low fertility exosomes drive pro-inflammatory responses, such as PGE and PGF2-alpha, prostaglandin E2 and F2-alpha, compounds used in clinical practice, and the two pro-inflammatory, interleukin-1-alpha and interleukin-8. Again, you can see tripled and above. So the infertile or lower fertility cows have an endometrium, we believe, that is reflecting a very pro-inflammatory, not a response, but an environment. It's hostile. Pro-inflammatory. Anti-inflammatory is pushed down. Any kind of interaction, not going to happen. Very much like some of the problems we see in clinical medicine and infertility. And then, and I have to admit I'd forgotten this, I went back and looked at the data that Caroline Walker generated in the early days of our collaborations, in which she was looking in endometrium and gene expression. And sure enough, in a paper like 5 years earlier, 2012, 6 years earlier, they found that the CXCL11 and 10 were both reduced in lower fertility strains. This is the one we showed, as well as 9, and this is the other one. So, surprisingly, maybe we're starting to build a story around inflammatory conditions and the glue-like substances that hold endometrium and trophoblast together, separate from perhaps that interaction with interferon tau, which I would come to later, but I decided time would not allow it. So transition cows, and here this is really where Mallory and John were highly involved, so I throw my hands up, but they had separated out cows with low risk and high risk based on their NEFAs and the beta-hydroxybutyrate and the triacylglycerols from the liver. And then we set about looking at exosomes from the two groupings. And we have two studies. I'll just show you results from one. We've got the original and a much bigger one coming out from Fatima, who is a PhD student following in Mallory's footsteps. And what you can find, this is from Mallory's study, is that you can separate these. Now, there are low numbers because we had a higher setting on the mass spec. But again, there are factors in here that are unique to high and low that are there ready for us to develop. So the concentrations are similar, but we have these things, and they're not compounds you'd immediately think might be important. And I always have this argument with some of my cousins who do these novel compounds. They say, oh, we're going to do this for novel compounds. And they come to this and they say, oh, well, they don't count because they don't look like they might be involved. And I say, well, why are we looking for novelty if we're not going to accept that some unusual compounds will come out? And the one that really stood out is this one. This is a fetal liver product, unique to the fetal liver. And it was different between the two groups, and this is one that we are continuing to look about. And all of them have some link to metabolic syndrome and liver function in humans, and we might imagine that the same would be true in dairy cows. So that all sounds fine, and I'm going to come to the real answer, but really, what are we going to do about it? And although I'll show you the data later, this is how you can do something. Here we have the lower fertility cow. What are you going to do? Well, some people have used meloxicam. Scott, if you're out there, I know has had some good results with meloxicam as improving fertility. Meloxicam, if you don't know, is a relative prostaglandin 8 synthase 2 inhibitor. So it's inhibiting inflammatory reactions. Aspirin just kills off all prostaglandins. 143 has antiphospholipase and will suppress prostaglandin production. So it's also anti-inflammatory. The anti-IL-17 and 23, anyone suffering from psoriasis or similar things, you will find that that's the latest treatment they'll give you. This is anti the pro-inflammatories. And I'll come to CRISPR-Cas. You can put things in that might diminish. So what you do is you bundle them all up into an exosome, shoot it in the bum and deliver it, and change the whole thing around to be a positive factor for placentation, and anti-inflammatory. And so through that, you can have treatments, microRNAs, which are treatment, and gene editing. And so you can influence the environment of the uterus to be friendly rather than hostile. How are you going to do this? Well, this is a load of how we do it. But basically, you can take exosomes, and we make them from milk. There are multiple ways of getting drugs and things in. You can put all of these compounds in. There are ways. What we did was use one microRNA 143. There was a mimic and an antagonist. Put it on some endometrial cells. Made some pro-inflammatory PGE. The microRNA in the exosome had an effect. Put the antagonist, blocked it. So if we can do it, probably most people will be able to do it. So you can load an exosome with the things you want. And what you can also do is load them with sections of the CRISPR-Cas system. You can actually deliver this gene editing into a cow, a human, or such. And doing it via an exosome makes it that much more powerful. So this is the paper I've chosen because there are only a few. But basically, if you load an exosome with aspects of CRISPR-Cas9 that are going to suppress the polymerase PARP1, which causes apoptosis, and then this is your control compound exosome only, and then intravenously. But look at this intratumorally. So what you're looking at is that size diminishing. So the exosome alone or the drug alone, not much, but you put it into an exosome, and whether it's IV or IL, you can reduce this. So CRISPR, gene editing, put in through basically a Trojan horse. Is that unusual? Well, maybe not. I apologize for getting into some clinical medicine. Paclitaxel, used for multiple drug resistance, you can put into exosomes. And the bottom line is, in its actions, which were done in vitro, I didn't bring the slide because it might get too much. Sorry. We find the paclitaxel, the drug, in an exosome is 50-fold more potent than the drug on its own. I took out the other slides because the other slides say, forget cost, but just think of the side effects being reduced for women. It'd be astonishing. But 50-fold is 50-fold. You're potent, you can put less in, and you can target it better. And the same, I think, will be true for other compounds. So exosomes provide a fantastic Trojan horse. Put into milk, in particular, doesn't have an immunological problem. And you could put it in gene editing materials. And if we know how to target, which is the next big frontier, we can do some astonishing things. I thought since we're dealing with milk, I'd say there are exosomes in milk. We're interested in milk production. What might you do? I don't know if that's a broader aspect of the dairy. But what you find that between milk and infant formula, there are similarities and differences. And we identified this all at great cost, sending it off to QIAGEN over in Germany. And you can get all of these. There's over 100 of these microRNAs. But the key ones in milk that make the infant formula people salivate are these ones. And there are also ways, of course, to put the key microRNAs back into the infant formula. And so we're working with one of the companies on that. Milk production, quality of milk, maybe then infant formula. But there are ways where we can modify exosomes to insert the microRNAs, which we may think are missing. And maybe it's more infant formula, but the possibilities in terms of generating the milk de novo are large. There's an orange card you should give me. Thank you. All right, so here's how we do it. We'd shoot it into the tail vein. It can run around to any of the places you want, to the uterus, to the udder, and it can extrude compounds that can regulate either milk output, quality of milk, the endometrium, and its environment. So if you work from right to left, I don't know why I've gone Chinese today, but I'm going right to left. They're released by organisms. If it's the placenta, you can work it out. If someone will tell me an endometrial product, we can pull out much better exosomes. We can look, and we have found them in saliva. For humans is good, breast milk, blood and urine. We found them in blood, milk, and urine, and they are blood and urine are more difficult, believe it or not, than milk. I thought it'd be the other way around. So from this, maybe you can get prognostics, look for herds or such that have higher or lower fertility. You could look for developing mastitis. You can actually look in the exosome at which bugs are there, and if you can relate it back to the udder, maybe you have a rapid way of establishing if it's mastitis, and maybe you can reduce that spectrum of the antibiotic. It's all a possibility. And then in treatments, just imagine, you can either make them in milk, or you could develop cells and hit them with something to make them make the exosomes you want, take them out, purify them, and put them back into the animal. Basically, you can have gene editing on the cheap. Thank you.